This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Based on science, we can foresee tremendous stress in a future of extreme weather, rising seas, and climate disruption. It could hurt food production and displace hundreds of millions of people. Will we rise to these challenges as a human species? Dr. Timothy D. Snyder suggests much darker possibilities. Dr. Snyder is an American historian, a professor at Yale University, and affiliated with other European institutions. Two of his five books, Black Earth and Bloodlands, have rewritten our understanding of the mass killings by Germany and the Soviet Union during the 1930s and 40s. In a New York Times op-ed, September 13, 2015, Snyder raised a new alarm saying, quote, "Climate change threatens to provoke a new ecological panic," end quote. Is mass murder in our past or in our future? Dr. Snyder, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, given the subject matter, I've been looking forward to our talk and yet not looking forward to it. And before we get to the environmental parallels in our current world, could we look through some of the research you've done to say, well, for example, that many more millions of civilians died outside of death camps than in them? Why didn't we know that?
Right. So the book that I discuss that in is called Bloodlands. And in Bloodlands, what I try to do is move us away from the traditional ways that we minimize mass killing. We tend to either start from some nation or other that we're particularly interested in, or we criticize one political system that we don't like, let's say the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. What I did instead of that was to move away from the national and the ideological and try to return to the territorial and the human. And I began from a really simple observation, which is that the huge majority of the deliberate political mass killing that takes place in Europe in the 20th century takes place at a very short period of time in a relatively confined bit of territory between Berlin and Moscow between 1933 and 1945. Why do we not know this? We don't know this because we see things ideologically, we see things nationally, but also because that's a part of the world. It's precisely that part of the world which was behind the Iron Curtain through 1989. So researching things that we think we know about, like, for example, the Holocaust, actually requires us to look eastward. Just to take the Holocaust as the most familiar of these crimes, the entirety of the Holocaust takes place in this zone. Basically, every single Jew who's killed in the Holocaust is killed in Eastern Europe and not in the places that are more familiar to us.
So what rationale did Hitler and his cronies have for their invasion of Poland and the Ukraine?
Well, Hitler wanted war. The fundamental goal of Hitler's rise to power was to start a war. He wanted a war because he believed that the world was corrupt, that the present state of affairs did not reflect nature, that nature demanded of everyone racial struggle. And then in particular, Germans are unfairly confined in Central Europe and should have an empire which befits their status as a higher race. So the strategy, such as it was to destroy the Soviet Union and to take Ukraine, because Ukraine was believed to be correctly a source of fertile soil and thereby food and thereby political and economic independence and grandeur for Germany. Now, along the way, Hitler has to do a whole bunch of things which he hadn't really planned on. He didn't expect that he would have to fight a war against Poland or, for that matter, against Britain. He didn't know that Czechoslovakia could be so easily dismantled. So between 1938 and 1941, when the main war against the Soviet Union starts, we see a whole suite of destructive events in which the European order is essentially destroyed. Austria goes away, Czechoslovakia goes away, Poland is invaded in 1939, all in order to pave the way for the invasion of the Soviet Union. But over the course of those years, as states are destroyed, new forms of political anarchy are created which allow the SS, the Nazis, to figure out how a final solution can actually be implemented, and that is by way of mass murder.
So in a minute, we'll get back to your major warning about what people will do to protect their lifestyles. But first, I want to say I spent a few years reading about the Holocaust and the Hitler regime. and it was disturbing to realize that some aspects of National Socialist policy would be considered green, trying to restore nature. And although Greens are aligned with the left today, a green fascism is not impossible. Would you agree?
Well, what Hitler thinks about nature, I think, is crucial. I wouldn't want to speak for the Greens today, but I think it's probably fair as a general matter to say that they don't see nature as a kind of naked zone of natural resources to be exploited remorselessly by whichever people appoint themselves as the higher race. That's how Hitler saw nature. And by restoring nature, what he meant was restoring what he thought of as a state of nature in which people murdered each other by starvation continuously for no other reason except to exploit natural resources. So that's his idea of nature. And a lot hangs on what you think nature actually is. And I would say that most environmentalists probably see nature in a rather different way.
Well, that's a long conversation because I know Martin Heidegger, the Nazi philosopher, or at least he was for a while, said, for example, rivers have a right to exist for their own sakes and should not be dammed. And I know there are some American environmentalists who would agree with that. But that's not really why we're talking today. I mean, one of the great mass murders of recent times developed, as you say, in African Rwanda in 1994. We were told it was a tribal battle between the Hutus and the Tutsis. Was there an ecological side as well?
Of course there was. It's very rare to find an episode of mass killing in which there's not some ecological concern. We find it easier to decode the politics and the ideas. And in our own lives, what separates us from the Germans is that we Americans at least, Canadians, British, Australians, don't face day-to-day the kind of ecological uncertainties that even Europeans did back in the 1930s. It's that which blinds us to the economic side of atrocity, to the ecological side of atrocity. So anyone who studies Rwanda would know that the year before the mass killing began, there was an absolute decline in crop yields, which is an unusual event. And one would also want to know that there was a general belief inside Rwanda that land was short, that fertile land was in short supply, and that the civil war that was underway was largely about control of land. And then during the course of the mass murder, the people who murdered almost always took land, and people from one tribe would even kill people from their own tribe in order to get land. This, by the way, is very similar to the elements of the history of the Holocaust and other European ethnic cleansings and mass murders that we tend to forget, namely that it's always the case that a tremendous amount of real estate changes hands, either by the people who do the killing or by people who benefit from the killing and thereby are, in a general way, implicated in what happens. And so this can be something trivial, like people in Vienna in 1938 wanting bigger apartments, or it can be something more palpable, like Africans who are actually concerned about having enough food to survive. But either way, the sense of improving one's own fate can lead to be one of the sources of mass killing.
But would we kill each other just for lifestyle if we had enough food?
Well, I think, you know, the history of the post-war United States or the Western world generally demonstrates that it is possible to give people a sense of satisfaction. It's just extremely hard. And Hitlerian politics warn us that it doesn't have to be about actual starvation. What Hitler meant by Lebensraum, by living space, was not just controlling enough territory to survive. He mobilized survivalist emotions by talking that way. But what he really meant was that Germans had the right to have the highest standard of living in the world. They had the right to feel that they weren't falling behind, for example, the Americans. He put it explicitly that way. And I worry a bit that Hitler was on to something when he defined lifestyle as always being relative and always being subjective, that there's a lot to be said for the worry that Americans or others would behave badly, not because their lives were necessarily threatened, but because their styles of life were threatened.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Yale History Professor Tim Snyder. We're talking about the possibility of mass murder in the coming time of climate disruption. You write about several hotspots where mass murder might develop as a new final solution. I'd like to add one, and that's the border where Muslim Bangladesh meets Hindu-dominated India. We may be only decades away, Tim, from a tipping point where repeated incursions of rising seas drive millions of people out of Bangladesh towards where? An already population-soaked India. Do you see that as a possible flashpoint for millions of deaths?
I don't know about millions of deaths, but certainly you're right. And a number of other people have drawn attention to that, precisely that scenario. I decided in the conclusion to simplify things by concentrating on desertification scenarios like Libya, where the annual drought is expected to increase from 100 days to 200 days, to Egypt, where the Nile could very well go dry, right, in sometime in the foreseeable future, to Syria and Iraq, where the Fertile Crescent no longer exists, where ISIS fights from waterhole to waterhole. I decided for simplicity's sake to focus on those kinds of scenarios, but you're exactly right. As one moves into South Asia, Central Asia, East Asia, one also has scenarios which involve too much water and people having to move for that reason.
Tim Snyder, your New York Times article suggests China may be forced to adopt some of the same arguments that Hitler did. It's possible. Please take as long as you need to explain that scenario for us.
So let me take two steps before I answer that question. The first step is to repeat that these kinds of arguments are not necessarily about the Chinese or about the Germans or about the Americans. They have to do with modern politics. So if I say that China has a Lebensraum problem, I'm not saying that the Chinese leadership is necessarily like the Nazis or that the Chinese are prone to this kind of behavior any more than anyone else. What I would be saying is that China, in the early part of the 21st century, faces a situation which is rather similar to that of Germany in the early 20th. Namely, you have a big, prosperous, developing, exporting economy which cannot guarantee itself from its own land a reliable supply of food and therefore is anxious, always anxious, about international markets. The second step I would want to take before pointing to the risk is to try to draw a distinction between local episodes of genocide and the kinds of international episodes which would be the greatest danger. We've already mentioned South Asia, the Middle East, Syria, Africa, places where episodes of ethnic cleansing and genocide have taken place in the last quarter century or so. Now, horrible as all these events are, they involve state failure and ecological panic, two of the factors that I highlight in the book. The truly horrifying scenario, the worst of all possible scenarios, one which would be much more similar to the 1930s and 40s, would be when a state with state capacity, with the ability to think ahead, adopts some ideology about how other people are to blame for ecological problems and destroys other states. That is, you see, what actually happened in the Holocaust. The Holocaust was not a matter of the German state becoming authoritarian and killing its own citizens. It killed almost no Jews on the territory of pre-war Germany before the war. What the Holocaust was an artificially generated resource war, which had the consequence of destroying other people's states, creating a political vacuum in which an ideology of anti-Semitism could actually lead to mass murder. So what we have to worry about in the future, most of all, is that some powerful state which can think ahead destroys neighboring or distant political structures based in some kind of ideology about how this is right. So the Chinese scenario depends upon a lot of historical thinking, as well as a lot of, you know, attempts to understand the Chinese point of view, which is a bit different from ours in terms of resources. And the particular things that I'm worried about are existing Chinese investments, leases, attempts to control land in East Africa, as well as Chinese possible moves in the future northwards towards Siberia.
Now, in the United States, in the Republican-controlled Congress, climate denial is rampant. How does that compare to Hitler's opposition to science?
Well, I got to say, in general, I think this is not going to be a moment on which we look back with pride. I wouldn't want to say that, you know, these people are like National Socialists in every respect. That would be completely ludicrous. All I'm saying is that if we read the sources, if we read the history, we notice things about the origins of the Holocaust that make us uncomfortable and should make us uncomfortable. The problem with the way we think about the Holocaust now is that we only talk about it when it already aligns with our existing worldviews, right? So American Republicans would generally say the Holocaust was the result of a German authoritarian state, which arose because there was too much social democracy and a too big welfare state and so on and so forth, which is total nonsense. It's historically completely nonsense. The thing that we might want to pay attention to in the present moment is the way that Hitler, in his own writings and practice, brought science and politics together. What Hitler said was, we must compete now. We must struggle now. We must fight now because science cannot save us. He specifically denied that science could create a more bountiful future for the Germans, for the Europeans, for everyone. He specifically denied the relevant technologies of his day, which were the hybridization of grains, irrigation, pesticides, fertilizers, because he needed to claim that all there was conflict. So this is not just like today, but it certainly casts some light on a mistake that we can make today. We make a similar mistake today if we say that climate science isn't real, alternative energy isn't real, because in doing that, we make a mistake in principle and a mistake in practice. The mistake in principle is to say that science is politics and politics is science, to say that the scientists are just one more lobby, it's just one more opinion, you know, they're paid by somebody, why should we believe them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is a Hitlerian move, because what it does is it removes the possibility for hope in the future. If there is hope for the future, then there's no need for conflict now. The practical mistake is, if you don't support science, then you in fact are co-creating a world in which actual resource conflicts are not only more likely, they're going to come much faster. And in that world, the danger of all kinds of conflict, including bloody conflict, which would be called genocide or ethnic cleansing, is much more likely. So we need the reality of science, but we also need hope, because as the years pass, we're all going to see, as most of us already feel, the consequences of climate change. And as that gets worse, it's very important for us to think that there is something that we can do besides take other people's land. And there is something. The question is whether we believe in it and invest in it sufficiently in time.
Isn't there a large difference, though, between using computers and modern transportation to round up millions of people into death camps, as Hitler did, and the historically natural death by starvation that happens to any species who have multiplied beyond their food supply? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure I understand the angle of the question, because Hitler's point of view is that nature demands of us that we think racially and exterminate other races. That there was nothing, in fact, biologically or zoologically or naturally determined about that. That was a matter of policy. And of course, Hitler has the actual science 100% wrong when he denies that irrigation and hybridization and pesticides and fertilizers are going to work. He's completely wrong. In fact, within a few years, the problem for Europeans is they have too much food, not too little. So the Holocaust is a matter of political choices that are justified by a certain extremely pessimistic view of nature, and one which excludes the possibility that scientific innovation can change the relationship between people and their natural environment. So that kind of thing is very different from natural selection. Hitler claims that it's the same thing as natural selection, but it's not. The danger that I see is that as conditions get objectively worse, then the kinds of politics that Hitler propounded, personalizing a sense of anxiety or a sense of envy, rather than working structurally to improve the future, those kinds of politics become ever more tempting. And I'm afraid whether one looks at the rise of the Popular Front in France or populist nationalism in Europe in general or the current presidential debates in the U.S., we are already tipping in that direction.
So from your studies, as we start to wrap up here, do you think there's a way that we could immunize humanity to any degree against this urge to use mass murder during periods of climate stress?
Of course there is. The sense that everything must happen in the present moment, the sense of what I call in the book ecological panic, it's something that we're capable of. That's the lesson of history. We can be pushed in that direction. We can stand over a pit in Belarus and Lithuania and shoot babies on the logic that it's them or us. We have demonstrated that we can do that. But we have also demonstrated that we're capable of building out the fourth dimension of time. We are capable of looking back into the past and learning, and we are capable of inventing scientific techniques which allow us to believe that there's going to be a future. We're also capable of that. Both of those things are possible, and you know, the Germans, for that matter, have done each of those things. So that what that leaves us with is the possibility of choice, the reality of political choice, the reality, which is a little bit frightening, that we actually have responsibility for which way things go. We can choose to believe that all that's left is conflict, or we can choose to try to behave in such a way that builds out a future for us and for everyone else. But that is down to us.
Briefly, what is your latest book and what are you working on now?
Well, the latest book is the one that we've mostly been talking about, which is Black Earth, the Holocaust as History and Warning. Most of the book is devoted to history. I develop at great length an argument about how Hitlerian ideology interacts with a sense of ecological panic and works itself out throughout Europe insofar as states are destroyed. At the end of the book, in its conclusion, I develop a few scenarios about risk for the present and future. What I'm working on now, mostly I'm drawn into thinking about the connections, these connections between present and past. I'm looking forward to a future in which I could occupy myself with something else entirely.
Me too. Our guest is Dr. Timothy D. Snyder, author and professor of history at Yale University. Tim Snyder has written a series of authoritative books on mass murders by the Soviets and the Nazis. Find links to Dr. Snyder and his books in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Tim, thank you so much for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
So glad I could. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.